their secret mountain lair somewhere in Colorado. This is the Image Doctors Photography Podcast with your hosts, Jason Odell and Rick Walker.
Hey everyone, I'm Jason Odell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And welcome back to the Image Doctors Photography Podcast. It's good to be with you again, Rick. How are you doing today?
I am doing fine. We've got potentially interesting weather coming in.
Oh, yeah.
Snow. What's the term?
Snowpocalypse or Snowmageddon?
Snowpocalypse. I couldn't figure out where to put the break between.
Yeah, it's going to either be crazy or not, depending, because it's Colorado, where, and for our listeners who don't understand, it's like they will sometimes predict, you know, a few inches of snow and we'll get nothing, or sometimes they'll predict a lot of snow and we'll get nothing, or sometimes they'll just predict a couple inches and we'll get a foot of snow. And so some of the weather forecasts, especially for the folks that are up in the Denver and especially the Boulder area, I hope your son is ready to dig out.
And keep in mind, we're recording this a few days before the snow is.
Yeah, so we're supposed to get snow over the weekend, and they were saying anything from 10 to 20 inches down here, but possibly up in Estes Park, I've seen, you know, which is where Rocky Mountain National Park is, I've seen estimates of almost 5 feet of snow, 56 inches.
Insane.
So we're going to find out, but it's going to be, somebody's going to get dumped on somewhere, and if you don't hear from us for a while, it's because we're still shoveling out next week.
Yeah.
But that being said, it's still good right now. So we're going to make sure we get our groceries and all those other things. But
done as yesterday.
Yep. Couple of good things come out this week. We're going to talk about the announcement from Nikon about their new Z9 mirrorless flagship camera. And they just sort of leaked it. Not just leaked it. They just sort of released a teaser, if you will. But we're going to talk about what we can sort of extrapolate from some of the press release there. And this is a cool thing. And then another thing that came out this week was what started off as just your typical modest update to Adobe Camera Raw, which they come out periodically with camera and lens database addition, you know, new camera support. That's pretty typical. But they added in a new feature in Camera Raw, which is something called Super Resolution, which is used to up-res your RAW files. And we're going to talk about that because it's kind of interesting.
And it looks cool. It looks promising. But as Jason knows, I've been putting myself into a state of utter madness over the last couple of days trying to understand some things, and there are a few bugs in there, so we'll forewarn you about that too. But bottom line is, it's got really interesting potential.
Yeah, it's really cool. So
stay on for that piece too. It's interesting.
So all the buzz the other day was that Nikon finally announces that they're that the Z9 flagship is in development, and what that really means is that it's been in development for a long time.
Yeah.
What we've learned from Nikon is in recent years, they will say, okay, we're developing this camera, and then what? But within 6 months, it's available or being released. And I think this goes back to, they had some bad press when they announced the original D2X was going to be in development, and then people sat around and wondered where the heck it was going to finally show up. And this was in 2004 when I think they announced it, and it didn't come out until the summer of 2005. Anyway, I mean, that all being said, this is a really important announcement for more than just because of what this camera will potentially do, but you know, before we get into what they've announced on it, the important message here is that they define this as a flagship camera. And it was very clear with the mirrorless line that that was what Nikon was lacking. The Z6 and 7, especially the Z6 and 7 IIs, are excellent, excellent cameras.
Absolutely.
But they are not made really with the intended market of that flagship. And I think it's important to understand that the flagship camera not only being expensive, this is the thing that anchors your line. This is the thing that people aspire potentially to owning. It's the one that the pros use, right? I mean,
quote,
yeah,
they
quote
actually
unquote.
Use everything.
They use whatever that works best for them. Yes, and I know plenty of them. So we were talking earlier that the notion of flagship has been kind of weird for Nikon ever since the D4 and D800 came out, which was I think in 2010, 2011, somewhere in there.
Somewhere in there.
Yeah, and the reason was it was that prior to the D800, all of Nikon's cameras were 12 megapixel, every single one of them. And so the discriminators were between the flagship and the other bodies in the range were simply, it wasn't about megapixels. It was really about build quality, frame rate, autofocus, just, you know, all of those other things that go in besides the sensor. And the D800, I think, threw a wrench into that paradigm that the flagship, you know, the thing that you want, because now all of a sudden you had the flagship build cameras being somewhat, you know, they're faster, better ISO performance, but lower resolution than the D800s and the, you know, the D850s and, you know, and those cameras. And so professionals had a real question: am I shooting for resolution or am I shooting for speed and action and stuff? And with the price difference being so massive, I think that was a legitimate question. And I was very happy with the 850s and put a battery grip on it, and I get 90% of what I would have wanted in a flagship camera. Whereas in the past, I would have gravitated towards the D3, the D4. You know, we had those,
right?
You know, so it's good.
And
to
at
see
one
this.
Point. I had a D3S, which was the 12 mm-hmm. megapixel thing that was high frame rate. And then I had a D3X, same basic mm-hmm. body.
Right.
Different resolution. That was a 24 megapixel one, which
right.
at the time, it's kind of funny. It was viewed as an insanely high resolution. Gosh, you must be using it on a tripod, and it's 24 yep. megapixels. Yep. At any rate.
It was also $8,000.
It was a lot of money.
It was a lot of money. Nice camera.
Yeah. So yeah, it's kind of changed around a bit, and who knows, we may end up back at that point again. But I think the key thing is Nikon is saying that the Z line matters. I think there's an implicit message that that's where the future investment is mm-hmm. really going to be. And I think we'll see other additions to the line. Maybe a high-res Z8 that has some of the features of the Z9, which we'll talk about, but not all of them. But let's talk about the Z9.
Yeah, it looks really great. I'm just on the Nikon USA website where they talk about it, and then they've got a photo, and it's that classic integrated vertical grip build. So it's going to be bigger than either of the existing Z bodies, which isn't surprising. It looks like it's going to have the weather sealing. Before we go into what's on the camera, though, I mean, Nikon talks about three major things that they talk about, you know, in their marketing materials. One is the sensor. So it's a new, it's a full frame FX, whatever you want to call it, FX format, stacked CMOS sensor. What does that tell you? What is that telling us?
Well, let's do one more step and then talk about what it tells us. The other thing is it shoots 8K video.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Without talking a lot about 8K video, what we can tell about or other features are, one, it's probably going to have resolution at least on the order of the Z7. So probably at least 40. Something megapixel resolution that's related to the 8K capability.
Okay, so that tells us that.
Mm-hmm. The other thing is the stack CMOS sensor tells us that it's likely to have electronic shutter speeds and performance similar to what you see with the Sony A9 family, where you have very little of that problem with distortion on moving subjects because the scan rate is too slow. So the scan rate will be really high. And so you'll see most likely really high frames per second, think 20 to 30 frames per second, be able to do the electronic shutter and take more or less whatever kind of photo you want to take. You don't have to worry about the distortion mm-hmm. in the subjects as much anymore. Mm-hmm. That's the thing to take away from as being the most likely outcomes.
Right.
Because of those features.
And you're probably also going to be getting rid of any kind of perceived shutter blackout, right? I mean, that's
right.
That's
right.
Going to just go away. So that's potentially very good. That's what we're kind of just inferring from this. And then the third thing they mentioned is the processor, which Nikon, we are assuming it's going to be the next generation XPEED image mm-hmm. processing engine. We don't know how many of them there'll be, if it will be, because the Z7-2s and the Z6-2s now have two XPEED, I think it's six. XPEED 6, so maybe we're looking at XPEED 7 now. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. But a new chip means all of those things we talked about before with the improvements in mirrorless cameras really being microprocessor dependent, not just the frame rates and the scan times, but also the autofocus systems. And you told me you heard somewhere where Nikon mentioned the autofocus performance of this camera would be as good or even better than what's in the D6 DSLR, correct?
They actually said better.
And if that were to be true, that would be tremendous because, yeah. I mean, as good as the autofocus has been in all of Nikon's cameras, the D6 really has some speed advantages over the, if you did a head-to-head test from clients that I have and people that I've spoken mm-hmm. to, where they've shot with even a D5 or a D6, they will tell you the autofocus matters there, and they get more certain shots with certain action subjects with that camera than they would with any other camera, even though mm-hmm. that on paper they're all pretty close in terms of right. what they're supposed to have under the hood. So right. so that's a pretty bold statement.
Now, and then we talked about the 8K video in a different way, but it will shoot 8K video. We don't know if there are limitations on that in terms of where it's stored and formats influencing where files are stored, like log files. Mm-hmm. But it does do 8K video. So, and that's probably one of the reasons why you need that new XPEED processor too.
Could be.
So for someone that is really into high-end video, that could be a tremendous thing going down the road.
Absolutely. Now I'm going back to the picture. I'm just kind of zooming in on mm-hmm. the picture on the Nikon website. There's a couple of things that we both noticed that make us sort of optimistic about, that are things we would like to see in our existing cameras and mm-hmm. don't. Certain things that we miss. I'm looking at the front of the camera. It looks like it's got a built-in flash illuminator, which is interesting, but it's there. But if you look, you see the two grips, and the ergonomics look like classic Nikon layout. But we were looking at the power, the little on switch, which goes around the shutter release. Mm-hmm. And there's that little light bulb icon on there
to light things up.
The illuminator. Now, that you might be saying, well, what's the point of that? Because the top LCD is usually illuminated as it is. You've got your rear LCD, which is always illuminated. Your electronic viewfinder
otherwise
is illuminated.
It would be black.
Right. I mean, so in the on the DSLRs, that was usually used to light up the top LED panel. But, and this is where we got to get happy, it implies that there will be illuminated rear buttons.
That's our guess.
And can't prove it, but it strongly suggests that might be there. Because what else would you be trying to light up otherwise?
It could be something we're missing. And but, again, this is just our guess, but
right.
that's something that we've wanted. So maybe it's wishful thinking.
It could be.
I could see them definitely doing it.
I will tell you, for anybody working, doing any kind of outdoor night photography, it is wonderful to have the buttons illuminate. So it wasn't something I thought much of until it was a feature I didn't know I needed until I had it. And all of a sudden, I miss it. And then
the other thing it's got is, if you look on the front of the camera, mm-hmm. it appears to have the 10-pin connector. style port,
right?
You know, like you would find on a D6 or
it actually has two. So one
but
might
I think
be
the other one is a PC.
Yeah, like a flash sync cord or something, mm-hmm. or a flash with the weather sealing rubber covers over them.
Yeah,
and that doesn't sound like a big deal, but it's a big deal for the pros, because I like using my old 10-pin connector. They screw in, they don't pop out. And most importantly, it's on the front of the camera. So I don't have to open that side port, especially if you're using like an L bracket.
It's just a mess.
It's just those existing USB remote release cords. They're just not as, I don't know. They're just more fickle, I guess. They're easy to pop out.
Yeah.
So
my main issue is just the L bracket.
Right. It does mean that you would potentially be able to use whatever else, you know, the Nikon accessories that use a 10-pin accessory port. So there, you could potentially put in, you know, other things too.
There are GPS receivers,
right.
For example,
yes,
that fit in those, and that's a pretty good spot for them.
And
so
that's
interesting.
You know, and one thing that they don't mention, but I'm going to guess if it's truly going to be a flagship that is competing with their, you know, that is sort of D6 level, you know, or better, it will probably have a lot of networking, wireless and whatnot capability built into it too, for those pros who are shooting mm-hmm. and they upload photos over, you know, connected to a local area network or something like that. That's my guess, but you know, that who knows.
Finally,
but it looks
pretty
cool.
Probably have two CF Express slots.
Yeah, that's a good point. It'll probably have CF Express. It'll probably need to take advantage of those faster transfer mm-hmm. rates. And it kind of goes without saying that they'll have two card slots. It's just whether
so
or
not
the second
slot. Card.
Right, that's the question. Thinking. Would it be two of the same? There's probably enough space in this body. Oh, and one other thing, speaking of space, if you look at that bottom grip, you can see the battery chamber cover there on the bottom. It's probably got a new, larger battery just for all those reasons. Pros are going to demand a battery that gives them, you know, at least 1,500 shots, you know. So
that's a guess on our part, but there's probably something going on with the battery configuration. It's
probably won't be the existing battery that we, the EN EL15 series. It'll probably be
you could talk
else.
About putting two of them in there maybe, but I think we'll see something interesting for the reasons that you just said.
But it would make sense. The flagships tend to have a larger battery. They do this. But what is cool about this is that if this truly is what we're thinking, it presents the pro photographer, the Nikon photographer, or the, you know, extremely advanced amateur, you know, the prosumer, mm-hmm. with a... It brings us back to the possibility of having a camera that really is the one camera that can do everything.
Right.
It's got the best autofocus, it's got best video, and it's got enough resolution that you don't feel like you're compromising if you're doing portrait work, studio work, landscape work. You don't feel like you're going to switch to a different camera. And for a lot of pros, that's really important, because, you know, you're going to probably buy two of these, right? You're going to have one. And we talked about backups last week. Mm-hmm. So chances are, if you have two of these, you've got, not that I'm going to be buying that, you've got two identical bodies that work exactly the same way. They deliver the exact same resolution. You're not making compromises going back and forth between cameras, because they do have subtle differences sometimes. Sometimes they're... You don't think about them until you use a different camera, and all of a sudden you realize, oh, that's right, I don't have that feature on this camera. So,
yeah, it just depends on the person's preferences. That is usually not bothered me much, but, you know, there are advantages to having two identical ones for people doing the kind of shooting that you were talking about. It can be shooting with one of these and a 500 millimeter f4 lens on it, and another one slung around your back with a 70 to 200 on it,
mm-hmm.
something like that, you know, at a game. But at any rate, I think it looks cool. I'm pleased to see it. I I'm interested to see what a Z8, if that happens, might look like. I think that could be really cool with some of these features, but maybe not the built-in vertical grip, maybe higher resolution, maybe not as much frame in the way of frame rates. Interesting possibilities. The important thing is it's a signal that they've committed themselves to the mirrorless format.
Right, which doesn't mean go sell your DSLR, but it does mean that this is where the future is heading.
Right.
And you know, I think really the only thing that I've seen it's people will potentially just take issue with the form factor that it is going to be bigger. Still probably smaller than a D6,
It definitely is, but
but it's going
still
to have
big.
that. If you're not a fan of that, you know, you can't detach that grip. I could see that, you know, but at the same time, you get a better weather sealing if you do it this way. So, I
Sure,
mean,
sure.
it's all a good thing. So anyway, that's our take on the new Nikon Z9, which is coming soon to a camera store near you, probably, I don't know, probably by the fall, you
Yeah,
know,
somewhere
or end
around
of
here.
late summer, September. That seems to be when Nikon brings things out. Who knows?
Yeah.
We'll find out. Okay, so let's talk about camera raw, which is something that we don't really talk about a lot, because it's just this, you know, it's there, we use it. Whether if you're an Adobe user, we've been giving Lightroom tips, you know, whether you know it or not, you're using some version of camera raw, because it's either what is pops up from Bridge, or when you try to open a raw file into Photoshop, you're going to get the camera raw interface standalone. It's also running under the hood in Lightroom. It's the Adobe processing engine, and it gets updated all the time. And most of those updates are simply new camera support, you know, new models of cameras and things being added in. Happens all the time. Most of the time, this happens in synchrony with a Lightroom update. So this Camera Raw 13.2 came out the other day, along with a Photoshop update. So if you're, you know, running the subscription. And I saw a blog post, actually it was, I think, on Facebook, from my good friend Josh Haftel. He used to work for Nick Software, is working for Adobe now, and we're friends. And he linked to an article written by another Adobe engineer or Adobe person about this new feature that is in ACR 13.2. And right now it's only in Bridge, Photoshop. It's not in Lightroom yet, but that's coming. It just hasn't happened yet. And it's this thing called super resolution.
Yeah, and I had actually seen it earlier than you that day just because I got up early or
Yeah,
something.
you were awake.
I didn't see Eric Chan's document, which is a good one, but I had started playing with it. And if our listeners remember several episodes ago, we talked about the enhanced details feature that's within ACR and Lightroom, where you can have it demosaic the image a little bit differently, and it results in improvements to certain kinds of image quality. This is an evolution off of that. That still exists as an option, but now you have this feature too. And instead of just enhancing some of the details or cleaning up artifacts, this does that while also doubling the linear resolution of the image. And if you double the linear resolution, you like go from 4,000 pixels wide to 8,000, you're multiplying the number of pixels total by four.
Right. So you're quadrupling the image resolution in
Yeah,
theory.
which is pretty cool.
So
And
it's
there,
up res.
yeah, and there's some programs that have been out there for years that do this. There was a thing called Genuine Fractals that
Oh
was
yes,
then
way back in the day.
renamed On1 Resize. And then Topaz came out with something fairly recently called Gigapixel AI, which is a resizing feature that incorporates artificial intelligence technology in it. And I've played around with that over the last several months. So this is in effect Adobe's version of that. And they've had, you know, traditional resizing things forever.
Right, and different algorithms in
But
Photoshop.
this is more of an AI-based approach. And it's got some really cool features. Think of it as version one, so it's got some bugs too. We'll talk a little bit about that just for people who choose to play with it. But at least from what we've seen so far, it's pretty damn cool.
Yeah, and so here's the thing. When we're talking about this AI, if you just make your image bigger in Photoshop or wherever, they will, even if you interpolate, they tend to look soft. You know, you can't the program has to fill in the gaps between the pixels when you make everything larger. And so all of these various bicubic, you know, sampling, you know,
Sharper, smoother.
all of those algorithms are done to try to make it look good when you do that. And in the old days, you know, it didn't work so great. The technology's come a long way. And what all of these companies are doing is saying, you know what? We're trying to train the software using whatever AI algorithms to fill in the details better. And then, of course, a big thing with Genuine Fractals was it also knew how to sharpen your image the right way when it resulted in the file, because you would get things soft. I mean, this is going back 15 years now. But so this technology has been around, is evolving for quite some time. What I find to be remarkably, what makes this unique is that unlike all of those other tools, which require you to use, you know, it's going to produce a TIFF, a rasterized TIFF. This is the one that literally produces a raw image in Adobe's DNG format from your original file. So you start with a raw file. Now, you don't have choices on size. It will double it, you know, like, so you don't have a lot of flexibility in choosing an output size. But what is really great about this is that when you're done, you're still in the raw format. And that has a tremendous workflow implication, because you can use your normal ACR, and presumably in, you know, in once Lightroom catches up, you'll be able to use all of your adjustment tools, your sharpening, your noise reduction, you know, everything on this monster, you know, 4x resolution file.
Right, which is tremendous.
And that the workflow implications of this cannot be understated, because it means, like, it's the difference between, you know, when you're using traditional software or plugins or whatever, you try some settings, you hope for the best, and then you realize it doesn't look that great. Well, you baked it into a TIFF, and now you got to start over from scratch. And that can be a pain in the ass, excuse my French, but I mean, it's a, you know, it's a pain. With this, oh, you need to tinker your sharpening settings, or do your, no, you know, you need to change this. You just do it on the raw file. And that in and of itself is huge. Now, you might be asking yourself, well, I don't need to double the size of my files. I'm already shooting with a 45 megapixel camera.
And you
And
very well might not need to.
exactly. I
But,
mean, that's
but.
fine. But that blog post brought up, you know, some interesting things. And then we were playing with it in the last day or so, come up with some interesting use cases where this might be very helpful, not on an every image basis, but on a you know, certain situations. And so some of those use cases, one is just not all of your photos were captured with a 45 megapixel camera, right?
Right. And you
I'm
may want to print some of those older 6 megapixel, 12 megapixel images at very large print sizes. And this can just get you a little bit better quality at those large sizes.
Yeah, and we did some testing where we just looked at up-resing regular way, enhanced details, and then using this file doubler, you know, this super res. It definitely gives you better details in the up-res file. It definitely does.
Yeah, it can do a
So
very nice job.
there was a
I think
clear
also,
improvement.
you know, one of the things that you've seen a lot of people doing in recent years because of high-res sensors is cropping way the heck in.
Right.
And bird photography is a really good example of that, where you know, you're just too far away. You've got a pretty big lens on there, but it's a small bird. And so you end up with an image where the resolution is not all that high. Well, this can pop it up a bit bigger again, and you can get back a little bit closer to maybe what you'd started with. So I think there are going to be some advantages for people working with those images, especially printing. You know, web display, who cares?
Right.
You don't need this for that. But big printed images, murals on a wall that you want to look at relatively close, it could be pretty cool.
Well, I'll just put it in perspective. I did a little video demonstration to put on my YouTube channel and my website, you know, demonstrating this feature. And what I did was I took an image that I captured way back when you and I were in Texas in 2007. It was probably like our first workshop ever, right? And I think it was our first workshop ever. Anyway, I was shooting the D2X with a 200 to 400 VR. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of 600 equivalent, but you know, by the time I cropped in, I was down to about 7 megapixel images. So by running that algorithm, I then produced a 28 megapixel image roughly. Now, obviously it's not the same, right? It's not real. You know, I mean, it is filling in the gaps, but it did it in a way that was very pleasing. And then I could get back to an image if I wanted to print it a little larger. You know, I can revisit some of those older files and say, hey, here's a way to make them bigger without losing anything and preserve the raw format on top of it. Pretty cool. And then we started thinking about other applications that were interesting, which was where you have a shot where maybe the lens, maybe you weren't stopped down, or maybe the lens is a little softer in the corners. So we were playing around with some images, some test shots with the 24 to 200 Z lens, you know, the S or whatever it's, you know, Z. And at wide open at 24 millimeters, it's a little softer in the corners, as you would expect with a lens like that. And so I ran it through this enhanced function.
Well, let's be a little bit careful, because I think we've still got some bugs in this thing.
Oh, yeah, no. But it was just a proof of concept. It was just to see what it would do.
And how about, let's say this. We found some interesting process things that you could do.
Yeah.
Seem to improve edge sharpness if you're doing perspective correction or you've got a lens that has a lot of built-in correction for distortion and things like that.
But well, here's what that. I did. I just ran it through this size doubler. I brought it into Photoshop, and then I resampled it back down to 50%. To get back down to the original file size. And what came out was a little bit better in the edges, in the corners, than comparing it against the original raw file.
Right.
And that was kind of, now, it is not like going to do this on it. I'm not going to run that on a thing.
No, I want to be careful with that, though, because we're seeing bugs. And
Sure.
And there were things I found that made that work better, but there's potential there.
Right. So we've run into a few little things. I mean, one, the file sizes are just insane. They're like, you know, so if you take a Z7 file or 850 file and you run this, you end up with a DNG file that's somewhere on the order of 670 megabytes in size.
Yeah.
And that can be variable. It's one of the things we're not sure about. And you can also, sometimes it's pulling out artifacts and making those bigger in ways that are undesirable. So you have to take care of that too.
Yeah. What I think is going on from what I'm seeing so far is with DNG files, you can force ACR to do an update to the DNG preview. And what I'm seeing is if you do that, it can affect color fringing, sharpening issues, a variety of things,
right?
And just make it weird. And that's why I'm a little bit hesitant to say what we can do and not do in the way of special tricks, because I don't know how much those bugs are playing into things. But if
again,
you do start using it, don't be surprised if you see some occasional weird color fringing or excessive sharpening showing up. And in some cases, you may need to use more sharpening. Like I found that with the Fuji X-Trans sensors. But
right.
just a little bit of forewarning. It's worth playing with, but don't come to any fundamental conclusions yet. It's still immature.
Right. But I think it's a step in a really cool direction. And I think it gives us some insight as to utility of stuff. You know, because I was just sitting around the other day thinking, like, well, you know how noise kind of disappears when you take a large image and you downsample it? You know, what would happen if I up-resed it using this tool, which, you know, and then re-down-resed it back to its original size? And it was kind of neat. So just things to play with. But again, I think this is really the core thing here is that it enables you to increase the resolution of your image while retaining a raw format. And yeah. That is huge.
Yeah. Again, I don't want to say too much about that up-res, down-res thing because people are going to say, well, it depends on which option you're using. Did you use
automatic,
smoother, sharper, because
those
will throw things off.
Yeah.
But there's potential here. I think this is cool technology. I think it will show up in other ways, including maybe some automated forms of enhancing problems with perspective correction and other things down the road.
And the other thing that we both noticed is that it's pretty fast.
Yeah. Like I said, I've played with the Topaz thing recently and the On One thing in the past. Topaz is horribly slow. I mean, it's like start it, wait forever, and then you get a TIFF. Whereas this thing is fast. I did see a bug where it said that the estimated time to produce the DNG was going to be 5 minutes on my laptop, and it was popping out in 15 to 20 seconds.
Mm-hmm. So, most of the ones I've done have been in that range too, 10 to 15 second range.
But the Topaz one takes forever, you know, think 5 to 10 minutes. And the other thing is I have found that I get a lot of weird artifacts in images that sometimes what it tries to do to enhance sharpening just completely falls apart. So you end up with a portion of the image that is horribly distorted and weird looking. And so far I haven't found that with this. I've just found the, you know, strange sharpening, color fringing things at times, but not all the time. So I feel very optimistic about it. I think it's very cool. It just needs a little bit more baking time.
Yeah. And that's the good news is that these things get tweaked all the time. We probably won't need to be waiting an entire year for those fixes to happen. Then they might not even advertise them. They just sometimes improve the stuff under the hood. Because,
right.
I mean, how many times does Camera Raw get updated a year? Usually 3+ times a year, if not more.
Mm-hmm.
3 or 4 times a year, you know, quarterly wouldn't be surprising just because new camera models come out all the time.
Yeah,
so,
and they're good about keeping it up to date.
So that's that, you know, it's just a cool little feature. And if you want to see how it works and test it out, it's not the most obvious function. There's no menu for it. You have to use a contextual menu, but I've got a YouTube video posted on my website at luminescentphoto.com where you can check that out. And I linked to that article on our Image Doctors Facebook page. So you can check that out there too. So that's facebook.com/imagedoctors. Let us know what you think about that. But that's all the time we have for today. So until next week, unless we're digging out from Snowmageddon, we'll see you soon. So happy shooting.
All right. Bye-bye.